We are going to go ahead and get started now. I'm going to open it up to everybody. Thank you all very much for coming. Come on in. We have Dr. Mark Pimentel here. We have Dr. Allison Seebecker standing by as well. I'm Siobhan Sarno with SIBO SOS, and glad you are here. Hey, guess what? Is my mic on? Can you guys hear me? Gallery view. Yep. I see you, Dr. Pimentel, and you look amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Just really good. Okay. I just don't know if the camera's picking me up, which is really not the most important thing, so I don't really care.
I can hear you, Siobhan.
Okay. Great. Okay, it's working now. And guys, chime in on the Q&A box and say hello. Let us know where you are. We are going to start promptly. We have about 4 more minutes before we do get started. And hi, come on into the Q&A box versus the chat box. But hey, Legacy182XX, it's good to see you. Hi from Gerardstown, West Virginia. My husband's from West Virginia, son of a coal miner. Love you. Okay, come on into the Q&A box. We're going to get you out of the chat box just for, so Karen and Mariel, who are standing by to do customer service, can help you in the chat box. And hi, Dr. Seebecker.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
So Dr. Pimentel, just before we get started officially, how has it been after DDW and all these amazing announcements?
Oh, it's been like the Wild West. It's been quite crazy. A lot of attention, a lot of interest. But you know, you don't just present at meetings. Now we got to send all the papers in for submission. So that's what we've been working on. And most of the work has been submitted. So it's a lot of work.
It is, yes, isn't it? I mean, I just know big projects are a lot of work. When you say sending them in, like submissions, are you talking about to like medical journals? Is that that's
right? You know, the first presentation of a piece of data is often the abstract at a meeting, and then you present on stage or on posters, but then you got to create a manuscript and you've got to send it to a journal for peer review. And that's usually about 30 pages for each presentation. So it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And you're changing the course of history.
One paper at a time.
One paper at a time. Helping heal the planet one tummy at a time, I always say.
Yeah.
We'll take it. And Dr. Seebecker, how are you doing?
Oh, good. I've been having a head cold, so if I sound weird, that's why.
Well, you sound fantastic. I'm just glad you're here.
I'm medicated. So.
Yeah, oh, good.
Yeah, you know, we don't have regular, real Sudafed in Oregon. They took it off the market years ago because of the meth issue. But oddly, you can buy it across the border in Washington. You know, isn't it weird how these regulations go? So I took a little trip over there and got some Sudafed yesterday.
That's just, yeah.
But I'm in a great mood.
It's great. I'm just glad you guys are here. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Everybody, we are going to start in about 2 minutes, but if you're here now, thank you. We have about 60 and counting. We have hundreds of people who are joining us today and will also be watching the recordings. Thank you very, very much for that. If we don't cover what your question was, we have some recordings from Dr. Pimentel earlier in the year. Last year, great information that is not outdated. So you can check all of that out at SIBOSOS.com. Also, a podcast from Dr. Pimentel and Dr. Seebecker are both on the new podcast, SIBOSOS podcast on iTunes. That's all free. Love to have you there. If you're not in the Facebook group yet, come to the SIBOSOS community because there's lots of fun stuff going on there too and lots of free information as well. Okay. Dr. Pimentel, is the MAST program going to go on forever? Like, is it like into perpetuity or is there a timeline on that? I just wanted to ask you that because I was just thinking about MAST in general.
Well, I guess until I retire or leave the medical campus.
Okay, so never? It's going to be there forever?
I hope it'll be there for a long time.
What exactly is the MAST program that you are leading?
So the MAST program is otherwise known as the Medically Associated Science and Technology Program. One of the things that I think over the years, as we've been working to try and develop new therapies for patients, is that companies that are trying to market or produce products don't always have a patient right in front of them, or they don't have a patient right in front of them, whereas we do. And so sometimes I think we know better what a patient may want or need because we're in the trenches. And we were developing new ideas and new thoughts around SIBO and the microbiome. And we said, well, let's go further along the path and see if we can help move things without being driven by the, you know, the money of big pharma and their agenda, and sort of move things in an agenda that's very patient-centered. And so that's why we formed the MASS program, to really bring not just the science, but the biotechnology to people, and in a way that is patient-centric. That's the whole approach.
It's a refreshing approach indeed. That's great. Great, great, great. Okay, we are going to get started right now. Dr. Pimentel, Dr. Seebecker is here. She's just hidden herself off of camera. There she is. Dr. Seebecker, just chime in and just say hello to everybody. The camera doesn't go to you until we hear you.
Oh, hello, everybody. Hello. I'm just going to go off camera during Mark's session.
Okay. And Dr. Seebecker will be giving us an update about what she's been up to over these many months of hiatus. That doesn't mean resting. It means working and researching, right? Or anyway, Dr. Pimentel, thank you for all of your work. Please tell us, what are the newest research updates that you recently revealed at Digestive Disease Week? Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on this podcast. So, we know SIBO is an important disease. We know it's a very significant contributor to IBS. About 60 to 70% of IBS patients have SIBO. We know, slugging SIBO with antibiotics seems to help, and there's other, of course, alternative ways to do it. But we want to be more finesse. We want a more accurate understanding of SIBO. And so, as part of the MASS program, which I described earlier, one of my missions was what was now called the Reimagine study. The Reimagine study is that every patient who's coming in for a scope gets some juice sucked out, and we look at their small bowel microbiome. You go back to 2007 when the Human Microbiome Project was published describing the microbiome of the gut. They called that the microbiome of the gut, but they only looked at stool. And so we said, that's really not where the action is. The action's in the small bowel, because that's the absorbing surface. And the surface area of the small bowel is the size of a tennis court. So if you spread like peanut butter across the size of a tennis court, that's a lot of peanut butter or a lot of bacteria. Anyways, to cut to the chase, we did a lot of things, or present a lot of things, on the basis of the first slices of the Reimagine study and the first large scale look at the small bowel microbiome. And for this particular audience, finally finding the individual characters and bugs that compose SIBO. And of course, different SIBO, different bugs. We've touched on that with methane, and we'll probably get to that later in this. But we're trying to define the phenotypes related to specific organisms that are part of SIBO, and then tailor your treatment eventually so that we know what works for you and why another thing doesn't work. So
the big question is, does this impact my treatment program right now? Is rifaximin like going to be off the table? A lot of people were asking, like, so is everything I knew wrong?
Well, it's more like everything you knew is modifiable. Because the thing about SIBO is, well, first of all, what we did with the first Reimagined study that we presented at DDW was, we showed that deep sequencing matches culture and matches breath test. So for those of you out there who do breath testing, we were able to validate that the breath test is accurate, and that any of the cynicism around breath testing has now been dispelled. So the breath test is accurate. What the breath test doesn't tell you is exactly the composition of the microbiome. And so we're still with rifaximin, because that's the most effective, use of rifaximin, FDA approved for IBS, with the treatment of the microbiome in mind. But, we're hoping that in the coming years, as we define exactly what bugs are characteristic of the phenotype of that person, we'll be able to tailor therapies and new therapies. But nothing yet, but this is the beginning of the new generation of things.
It's very exciting. When you're talking about the you were talking to me earlier about like you've confirmed what was cultured. Can you just kind of explain that a little bit more? Because a lot of people heard Highline and Headlines, but I don't think they really understood what the difference was.
So one of the differences is, for example, people have said that culturing the small bowel is the most accurate way. And so we did that, and we did find that that correlated with breath tests. So that's one part of it. But we also found that when we found those cultures to be positive, the deep sequencing verified it, because deep sequencing is the most accurate test. And even the most accurate fit with the middle accurate, which is culture, fit with the non-invasive, which is breath testing. So that was sort of the novelty.
So about the breath tests, they've been confirmed that there's no cynicism around them. There shouldn't be. What about the different substrates? Do you feel like the substrate, is lactulose, glucose, and all that? Do you feel like that makes a difference?
Well, I can tell you that the people who do glucose should be a little wary, because we weren't able to validate, or we didn't validate glucose. We validated that lactulose was predicting what we saw on the aspirates. So considering the fact that glucose detects half the number of patients as lactulose, it's not the right test. Lactulose will be the test of the future because of this.
Okay. And then your reveal was about hydrogen, right?
So for this particular analysis, we looked at the hydrogen portion of the breath test, found that the cultures fit, that the deep sequencing fit, but then in the metabolic analysis we did, the hydrogen production, this was another cynical comments made by critics of the breath test. They said, no, the lactulose is getting to the colon, and that's where the hydrogen is being produced. And we're sucking juice from the duodenum and showing that the bug or the microbial composition was upregulated hydrogen production. So the hydrogen is being produced in the small bowel, folks. We have data to show that that's where it's happening. But look, you can be cynical. That's why there is a scientific debate, and the challenge is then on me or others to prove if we're right or if we're wrong. And so fortunately, it came out in our favor this time, and for sure hydrogen is being produced from the small intestine.
Okay. We have a ton of questions, and I know we're going to keep talking about the research, but when you were doing all of the, it's not a biopsy, but when you were gathering all those juices and studying them, are you seeing mast cells? Were you looking for them at all?
So the Reimagine study is a very, very broad collection system. So we're collecting the patient's questionnaires. We are taking a biopsy to look for mast cells and to look for all the chemicals that the lining of your gut produces in response to the bugs. We are taking the juice, the bugs, and the juice that the bugs are in to do compositional analysis. We're taking genetics, and we're taking blood to see if, the one goal is 2 years from now, we have a blood test for SIBO. We don't have to do, all the breath or whatever. All these things are possible depending upon if we find one bug with one disease. And that's our goal. Our goal is to find the one bug related to one disease and see if we can get easier and easier and easier ways of diagnosing patients. Save time, save money mostly.
Dr. Seebecker and I were talking about one of the people on my team whose husband just had appendicitis. And I know that was like a big breakthrough. Could you talk about the breakthrough associated with the appendix?
Yeah, also one of the Reimagine sort of things we've done in part of the MASS program is we, first of all, for the small bowel, going back to that, we had to validate all the tools and instruments for small bowel. So all these people who've been sucking juice, they were not doing it as well as they could. And so we had to develop new tools, new sterile instruments. We had to validate the techniques for getting the bugs out. But as part of that process, we also came up with a technique where we could take tissue that's been sitting in the pathology department from your appendix or gallbladder from 10 years ago, drag it out of the formalin, unfix it, and still find the bugs. And so we did that with these appendixes, and we found that about 45% of appendicitis was food poisoning, Campylobacter specifically. And so it's really the first description that one bug is causing appendicitis. Can you imagine, that's the most common surgery in the United States, and nobody knew that Campylobacter is the cause of half of those cases almost. So that's a big finding. And, you know, we're continuing to dive into different organs and different tissues that may help patients.
That's huge. Allison, isn't that huge?
I'm here to chime in to say my mind was blown. I'm just going through all of the abstracts and I was like, oh my God. That's for a doctor, huge news. Like, oh my God, Mark.
Well, now if you can do a rapid test and you treat them with antibiotics instead of taking lopping out that organ, and there's, you know, you have all your organs for a reason, including the appendix. And we think the other thing we found in the appendix is kind of interesting, is we think the appendix is your, this is hypothetical, we think it's your lifesaver. So let's say you have something that wipes out all the bugs in the intestine, you take antibiotics. The appendix has the magic mix to repopulate. And so it's sort of, all these bugs are tucked in there, the antibiotics don't touch them as they're going through, and then they just repopulate your colon again so that you're back to normal. And when you take your colon out, maybe that doesn't happen. Maybe you don't repopulate correctly. So these are all things that we're exploring now based on these findings.
In that, I just want to ask a question about that. In that study, were you able to prove that theory of the repository of your microbiome in the appendix?
So in the normal appendixes that we had, because we had some normals and then we had some patients with appendicitis, the normal appendix contained almost an identical composition to what's found in stool. So, which is pretty remarkable. And in exactly the sort of the same, it's never exact, but it's very compositionally similar to what stool looks like in a normal person. So that's interesting because it's tucked away with a little valve on it and it just kind of holds things until you need them again. It's the appendix may be more interesting than we think and may not be just a throwaway organ.
This is that theory is what Dr. Sandberg Lewis has been teaching the whole time I've ever known him. It's a common naturopathic teaching, and it's just incredible that you were able to prove it. It's just incredible.
Well, more to do, always more.
And that study is incredible because, to my knowledge, no one really knew what was causing appendicitis. So just incredible.
Yeah,
that's brilliant. Really brilliant. Okay, so were you saying that all of that is the similar similar population to the stool? And you've said in the past that like the stool has the dead bacteria. In the appendix, was that live?
So we didn't do cultures because these are all preserved organs. So I can't tell you for a fact that that's true. But, you know, compositionally, the stool, half the bacteria are dead. It means that the composition is correct, but the numbers are off. So if you found 1 million bacteria in there, it's really only 500,000. But the composition of the 500,000 is the same as it would be in the million. It's just half of them are already dead. So that's sort of how you look at it.
Very cool. Okay. And then, so if, let's say we've had food poisoning and we have post-infectious IBS, are we at a higher risk of having appendicitis?
So what sparked this is a couple of things. I'd always had the feeling that appendicitis was untapped and we didn't have a technology to get the microbes out of there. And I always felt like it didn't make sense why people just suddenly get appendicitis out of nowhere. But a patient of mine who had eaten at a restaurant locally had gotten food poisoning, developed IBS, and then developed appendicitis. And it was proven that they had Campylobacter. And so I said, well, that's very interesting. Now that we have this technology, let's look. And that was it. So, you know, look, that's why seeing patients, connecting the dots, then going to science makes all the difference in the world in terms of developing things and finding things, because you got to be in the trenches. You got to see a lot of patients to see all these rare events and things that other people may not pay attention to or notice.
So just, we're going to wrap up on this topic, but if you've ever had like a FMT, fecal microbiota transplant. Would the appendix play a role in that theoretically, in like replicating your own again or mixing it? It's just a wild card question, and we'll move on.
We did have a poster on FMT, which is slightly off the question, but I don't like FMT for anything but C. diff at the moment, because I think what we're seeing is that in a lot of other instances, it may be harmful if not used correctly. So, but I don't know what happens after FMT to the appendix, or how the appendix plays a role in preventing the FMT from taking. All those things are lots of interesting questions that emerge that I don't have answers to yet.
Okay, so what else can you tell us about your reveals at DDW? And then we're going to dive into some general questions in about 10 minutes. Lay it on us.
Okay, so the other thing was the proton pump inhibitors don't do anything or hardly anything to your microbiome. So I think I get this question on almost all podcasts. If I'm on Nexium, sorry, don't want to pick a particular product name. If I'm on a proton pump inhibitor, is that going to mess up my microbiome? And shocking, it doesn't do anything. There is a slight change in clostridial species, and that's it. There is no SIBO. We didn't find SIBO more commonly in the PPI patients versus no PPI. I was personally shocked, because I thought at least there'd be something. But, you know, to be honest with you, it sort of makes me happy to know that, in the sense that the human body is very redundant. So you've got acid that kills bacteria, but then you got the migrating motor complex that keeps things in check, and you got bile that keeps things in check. And so when one thing falters or is weakened, other things can take over. And we do know when people are on PPIs, they have more migrating motor complexes. So it's interesting that the second wave, or a second, it's sort of like you have two walls in that prevent the castle from being destroyed. First wall is broken, second wall still up, you know. I think that's pretty amazing, to be honest.
Speaking of the body and the things in the body protecting and being redundant and all that, have you been exploring biofilms at all?
So biofilms is part of what we're looking at. So if, again, look, with the amount of material we get from one patient in the Reimagine study, just one aspirate, we get about 800 pieces of information, not to mention, you know, all the cytokine panels we do, if you add those in. But we take the biopsy, we wash the biopsy to get the biofilm. The biofilm is kept separately. So we haven't looked at all of them, because the amount of money per patient for all these samples is extraordinary. And so we've looked at the microbiome, we've looked at the metabolomics, we have the serum banked, we have the biofilm banked for other questions that emerge as we continue to accrue patients in the trial. Our goal is to try to get to 10,000 patients so that we can really connect the dots once and for all.
Do you have studies going on right now that people who are listening and we can spread the word about could be applying for to do a study? How many times do they have to come to LA? That kind of thing.
Well, right now, we haven't gotten to methane yet, but the lovastatin, non-absorbed lovastatin study is ongoing right now. We're super excited, and the enrollment is going fairly briskly. We're trying to enroll 150 people before October. And that's exciting, because in the first trial there were a few patients where their methane went away and didn't come back. So we're hopeful that this will create sort of a new world order of the microbiome for methane people who have constipation. So you have to be between 18 and 65, you have to have constipation, and you have to have a constipation without medication. So if you're on meds and you're doing okay, you can stop them and still be in the trial as long as you're constipated, and have methane on your breath test. But it's 5 visits to our center. So for those who are outside of California, it might be a little challenging. That's all.
And actually, in our Facebook group, you guys, there's a place where you can find out about how to apply to be on the application process for the study. Okay, do you want to switch topics to methane and hydrogen sulfide, two of your favorites?
Yeah. So again, our goal is to subcategorize a SIBO, because, you know, there's no one fits all treatment. One of the things that I say to patients is, I say, I'm not working for the patients who respond to drugs. I'm working for the patients who don't. Because, you know, when I give an antibiotic, rifaximin and so forth, and patients do great, and then I don't see them for 2 years, that's great. It's great for them. And we've made some big leaps in there in that, and I'm very, very excited about that. But the patients who continue to be in my clinic are the ones, the 30% who didn't respond. So we need to come up with better answers for them. One of the better answers is maybe this Syn-10 lovastatin product. Another, maybe this, we're missing a whole gas, hydrogen sulfide. So that, we didn't have any abstracts at DDW on that, but we're very close to making an announcement on hydrogen sulfide, but you have to stay tuned. But hydrogen sulfide, we know from the study we presented last year that it's predictive and associated with diarrhea. And we think that the patients with more extraordinary diarrhea, or even diarrhea in general, because the hydrogen sulfide is proportional, more H2S, more diarrhea. Same like methane, more constipation, or the more severe your constipation is. So that's a very exciting area, and unfortunately you have to stay tuned a little while longer for that story.
I know he's going to share that information with us as soon as he can. I know.
I promise, as soon as I can.
Thank you so much. If someone has hydrogen, I guess the question is, if someone has hydrogen dominant SIBO, how do they, do you know how they get methane SIBO? Is it just, I mean, is there, do you see any causation there, any mechanism that has made that happen in particular for some people versus others?
So what we've seen is two specific ways that this happens. Well, three, one new way. The first is that we live in our environment with our family, and we do see that methane clusters in families. We've noticed that in our clinics. So, you know, you're sharing bathrooms, you're sharing whatever, hopefully not sharing toothbrushes, but you're sharing items in the house. And this, I don't want to say methane is contagious. What I want to say very clearly is that methane colonization increases with age and exposure. And as the older you get, the more people suffer from methane. But we think that a lot of the people who are younger, they probably shared something with their parents and their parents had methane and so forth. But having the methanogens is not the crisis. The crisis is when they bloom or when they become overpopulated, and then you get the symptoms. The second is, we know in, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, the prevalence of methane is far higher than here, double or triple what we see here. And so in African and even African-American populations, we do see methane at higher levels, particularly in African-American. I'll leave the conclusion of that sentence because we haven't unveiled all of that yet. But I know, oh, you almost caught me. But we want to make sure we don't want to reveal information until it's published, because then they won't publish it. But we do find some very interesting racial and you know, family. And then the third way to get methane is a fecal transplant. We published the first example of this, where a person with C. diff found a donor, the donor had methane, they did a transplant, and now they're in constipation hell from methane. So that's some of the pitfalls and warnings about fecal transplant.
Okay. So we've covered some hydrogen, we've covered some methane, anything else that you want, and appendix, of course, anything else you want to talk about that you're, go ahead.
Yeah, from DDW, I think the most exciting thing is second generation testing for IBS, the IBS smart test, because we now have a more accurate way to diagnose IBS. So what I tell patients is, if I know where your IBS came from and your SIBO came from, because it's in the same path, you get exposed to food poisoning, the toxin produces an antibody, you produce autoimmunity, and the deeper your autoimmunity, the more your motility is off, the more your bacterial overgrowth is there, and sometimes if it's really high, these antibodies, the harder you are to treat. And so, plus, if you get food poisoning again, they go higher, and that's even worse. And so you have to, I mean, I need to know, and I'm doing this every day in my clinic. All our doctors are doing it, and a lot of people in California, because it's, I think it rolled out mostly in California to start with, but it's, I think it's in 35 states now. So it's rolled out quite nicely. But the point is, you know, and then you know about the result, and then you're able to at least guide the patient. But the second part of it is, you know, think about the patient. I put the patient right in front of my eyeballs when I do stuff. The patient wants to know why they have anything. So you have SIBO. Well, why do I have SIBO? You have IBS. Why do I have IBS? Right? You want to know why. And this test tells you it was from food poisoning, and you better be careful when you travel, careful what you eat, and also may guide prognosis. So I have some patients where over time I've seen the antibodies drop if I tell them and guide them through the process of what they're doing. I've told this story. Maybe I've told it on a podcast before. And if I have, forgive me to the viewers, but I have one patient who was positive on the antibodies, and she says, my family all wants to go to Costa Rica. And I said, you've heard the story?
Tell it again. It's a good one.
Okay. So I'm sorry.
No, it's great.
But I love it because it's a patient who has a worry about food poisoning and driving the antibodies up. And I said, don't worry, we'll give you prophylaxis for food poisoning. So we gave her off-label a half a rifaximin with every meal for the whole trip to Costa Rica, 20 family members on a bus, and 19 had food poisoning. But my patient, the sick IBS patient, was well the entire time. And now I feel bad for the other 19, but the point is, I wouldn't know to do that. I wouldn't know to behave in that way with this patient without this type of test. So that's why I'm you know, super excited about it.
So we have a lot of questions about that exact story, actually. Is it okay to take these antimicrobials with herbal or the rifaximin like fairly frequently as a prophylactic, like you just said, not just like on a vacation? I know one of our regulars, she doesn't have an ileocecal valve and has the antibodies, so she's super concerned about that. And where does the role of a prokinetic play come into this equation?
So, you know, again, we have to accumulate data to provide evidence-based approaches to all of this. But what I can tell you is, in my practice, if I see somebody with high antivinculin, that the higher the antivinculin, the more neuropathy we see visually on the patient. The patients who are the most distended, and some of them even end up in the hospital with distension, are when they're greater than 3 or greater than 3.5, so almost at the saturation point of the test. Those are the sickest patients. But what I'm getting at is, on the spectrum, if the vinculin is elevated, it means that you're more likely to need a prokinetic after antibiotics. You're more likely to relapse, is what we're seeing in the clinic. The test that I like to see is the CDTB is up, but the vinculin isn't, because it may be that you're that patient in those large clinical trials where you got food poisoning, you got IBS, but a year later it all goes away because you're not developing the autoimmunity. So the two antibodies work in sort of tandem in guiding how to tell the patient, guide the patient, and give them either optimism or temper enthusiasm, but maybe guide them as to a better approach, a more aggressive approach, depending upon those markers. But doctors don't know about all this information yet. You see, this is the problem. So they see these markers and they're like scratching their head because they haven't been educated around all the stuff you and I are talking about right now. And we're getting it out there, but it takes time. So if people out there in the, you know, the middle of the country somewhere are going to their doctor and their doctor says, I don't know anything about this test, they don't yet. It's like the early days of rifaximin in 2006 when we first published. People didn't know, and it just takes time for everybody to get up to speed. That's all.
Well, and I think it's the role of the, you know, the citizen scientist or whatever you guys want to call yourselves, the inpatient patient, your own patient advocate, spread the word. That is what the internet is for. Wishing people happy birthday on Facebook and spreading the information about the IBS smart test and this kind of thing, right?
Right. Empowerment. That's what I call it. Patient first. That's my mantra.
So, you know, that's what I did. I literally printed studies out. I print out the homepage for IBS Smart Test. They have tons of links to about, you know, and they're in the Facebook group. Just go to the website. It's very good. But if they're in, are the studies or the things that you were talking about at DDW, are they available for a patient to like download, look at, get links to?
DDW, I think you can get to the website and you can download it now because they've been presented. So the abstracts are available. I can't cite the website exactly or how it works, but if you go to ddw.org, I think you can find it. But one more thing I wanted to say about the test is that, look, you know, think about the patient who comes to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, we need to do a colonoscopy and this and that. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do colonoscopies when they're needed, but wow, they're expensive. And not only that, they're invasive. You have to prep, you have to take a day off work, your ride has to take a day off work to drive you, and then you get an invasive procedure. And it's almost always negative if you're, especially if you're under 45 years old. And so it just saves a ton of money to get the answer, get to treatment.
Okay, just to clarify fire from Josh, with those low dose of the rifaximin, he's like a nomad, he travels all the time. So he's constantly exposed to different foods. What do you feel like is a guideline for safety for taking these antimicrobials, antibiotics with food to reduce the chance of getting food poisoning?
We know rifaximin is safe because the FDA, unlike any other antibiotic that I know in history, the demand that the FDA put on the trials to prove that it doesn't mess up your microbiome and stool, that it doesn't cause resistance, it doesn't get absorbed, so it's not going to affect the rest of your body. So rifaximin has been proven safe in many, many facets. So half a rifaximin a day with half a rifaximin with each meal is what I do, how I treat my patients. But again, that's not on label use of the drug. But I can tell you that I know a lot of gastroenterologists who, when they travel, they're doing that. And so if it's good for them, why wouldn't they do? I mean, you know, so what I'm saying is they're protecting themselves when they travel, and patients with IBS who are susceptible. Let me tell you another thing about the SIBO IBS patient is that this has been shown. We did a study with the US military and we said, okay, so if these antibodies go up and you get autoimmunity and you get stasis of the gut to get SIBO, then maybe if you already have IBS, you're at risk for getting food poisoning more easily because everything's so slow. And the US military did the trial. They said, if you had IBS and you get deployed, you're 3 times higher chance of getting food poisoning when you went into deployment, AKA when you travel, you're 3 times more likely to get infected than your other family members who don't have this. So we want to mitigate that. And I certainly don't want the antibodies going higher because that will make you worse and harder to treat.
Got it. Is IBS Check the same thing as IBS Smart? Their websites both say they check for the same two antibodies.
Well, IBS Smart is the second generation test. It is more, the paper, by the way, is in press this week. You can search it on PubMed. It's more specific, more accurate, and has a greater post-test probability. The post-test probability of having IBS, if both markers are positive, are now greater than 98%. And both markers are greater than 90% specific now. So, and the likelihood ratio, which is a very complicated statistical thing, are both markers now more than 5 because we were able to create a test where the thing, parts of the protein where the antibody glom onto for the test are more exposed and therefore easier to detect. The bottom line is the test is better, works better, and is the next generation. And of course, we're working on generation 3 because we never stop. And so stay tuned for something even better in the future, we hope.
Ooh, this is exciting. This is breaking news. This is like, you know, you're in it, obviously, but like in my lifetime, I don't feel like I've had a lot of breaking news in the medical area of stuff that impacted me. Like my sister's had psoriasis for decades. Nothing has seemed to change. She's on a biological. It's better. But I mean, and I know people are working on that all the time, but like, that was like nothing better, you know, like, and this is like you, nothing. Now we have real information and it's going to get better.
Well, you know, Siobhan, all of that is very exciting because it comes in these amazing bursts to you. But for us, it's like the first 500 feet of a rocket taking off, where it looks like it's going really slowly. Because for us, you know, to gather the data, to get the hundreds of patients, it's months and years and tons of money to make it all happen. And the NIH doesn't fund this. It's crazy. I mean, they don't fund the most common gastrointestinal disease on the planet, IBS and SIBO, and they just don't put dollars into it. So we're sort of on our own trying to scrap money together. And that's not a solicitation. It's just, I know it's exciting. We have big steps every 6 months or so, but the amount of work that went in the last 2 years, knowing what this step would look like, and trying to prove it, it's a lot. It takes a lot of time and energy and money.
And there's no such thing as like an overnight success, right? You've been working on it for years, right?
Right. I was going to say a slow-moving train wreck, but it's not a train wreck. It's a rocket taking off, and I think that's a better analogy. And I think we want the rocket to go higher, faster, but it's all, you know, limited by resources as always. And we're not in a bad place. But I'm just of the type that I want an answer yesterday, every day, because I'm in the clinic. The patient comes in yesterday on Tuesday. Sorry, it was my big clinic day, and I saw a handful of patients who I'm having a tough time getting rid of their overgrowth. So I need something. I need it yesterday, because that patient goes home, and they're still suffering. And I'm sitting here, and I know they're still suffering at home. And I'm scouring the earth to trying to figure out a better way. So for the patients who don't respond to the traditional stuff we're doing. So that's what we're working for.
Yeah. So if you guys know anybody who wants to donate, the mass program online, if you can't find the website link, that I will help you find. If you can't find other studies and stuff, I am not Google, go to PubMed. Okay. So I mean that lovingly. But okay. I wanted to ask you about, somebody does an IBS Smart test, and they, how is it that they could have IBS but not SIBO? Can you explain that? We're getting a lot of questions about that refinement and that nuance.
The way I'm describing it lately, and maybe I described it to you like this before, but it's best to go back to ulcer disease. Ulcers in the 1980s, you had 100 people with an ulcer in their stomach, and then they found H. pylori. And they said, oh, H. pylori causes ulcers. Yes, H. pylori causes ulcers. But we didn't rename the disease H. pylori disease. H. pylori also causes cancer, but may not cause ulcers in those patients until the cancer forms. So H. pylori can be seen in ulcers and in other diseases, but of the 100 patients with ulcers, only 70 have H. pylori. The other 30 are caused by Advil or NSAIDs or aspirin or whatever else that we've, you know, science has proven. My point is, IBS is the same thing. IBS is this umbrella terminology of a condition that is defined by the FDA. SIBO is starting to be defined by the FDA in a way that drug trials could be developed, but that's in the works. But under IBS, 60 to 70% have SIBO. So it's sort of like the H. pylori story. But the other part of the H. pylori story and SIBO story is that a bunch of other people can have SIBO from adhesions and from pancreatic insufficiency cirrhosis. And so we have to be mindful that SIBO is not just a California roll sushi with IBS. It's it can be caused or be present in other conditions as well.
What do you see as that biggest underlying condition? And what do you suggest to people who are like, look, I did the IBS Smart test. It's not positive, but I still have SIBO. What should I do?
But see, this is where the testing becomes important. So people say, well, do I do the IBS Smart and do the breath test? Well, think of it like you go to your cardiologist's office. They don't do an EKG. They do an EKG and an echo, because the EKG shows you the heart rhythm and the echo shows you the heart structure. So it's that, you know, the antibodies tell you you have a dysregulation of motility potentially from food poisoning. And we talked about all the manifestations and why that's important. The breath test tells you what type of SIBO you have, whether it's methane or hydrogen, and guides therapy. But if the antibodies are negative and the breath test is positive, I'm more likely to investigate for adhesions or investigate for something else. Again, see, it's guiding me in how I am more likely to find what the patient's culprit is, knowing these first two elements. But to answer your question, the first part of your question, I would say adhesions are the most important cause. I had at least two patients in the past month where their doctor's been treating them over and over and over again for SIBO, and they had, one of the patients had blockages in their bowel, doing great now, perfect, you know, so.
Wait, how did you test and how did you get rid of it?
Well, you got to do the barium study with a qualified, very, very good barium person, not just somebody who takes one picture. And that's what we do. And now they're fixed, which is, you know, amazing. And I love when that happens because it's so rewarding for the patient.
Okay, well, how did you fix them? Because doesn't surgery lead to more?
They were nearly obstructed, so they had to have surgery. But there's, like I say, I see maybe two or three people a month that are like that. And that happens fairly routinely.
So I try to educate a lot of people about adhesions because it isn't the most talked about thing. And, you know, I have Larry Wern and Clear Passage as a resource to send people to, Visceral Manipulation, the Upledger and Burrell Institute techniques for this, you know, massaging. Do you have any other suggestions for people about adhesions if they aren't going to be going under the knife?
So adhesions can be handled in minor when they're minor with manipulation, visceral manipulation. And so I have used that. There are patients, remember, one of the reasons adhesions form is because they're tearing and repairing. My only concern with visceral manipulation, sorry folks, for those who do that out there, is that we don't want them to tear and repair in a bigger type of adhesion. So unless you're qualified and you know what you're doing, that's really my word of caution. That's all.
Yep, Carlene, I'm talking to you when I'm going, yes, 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 because we've had this conversation several times. It shouldn't hurt. This visceral manipulation in the belly. I've had it done, and so I've had it done improperly, and I've had it done properly, and it doesn't cause like inflammation and another like adhesion environment. It actually is quite gentle. You have to go to someone who knows what they're doing.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about the research?
So much happened. So off the top of my head, I think we've covered a lot of it. I think you have questions for me, right?
I do. Oh, funny you should say that, Dr. Pimentel. Okay, knowing that bloating is a hallmark symptom of SIBO, have you ever encountered a positive test for a patient without bloating?
Positive SIBO without bloating. So when we have the hydrogen sulfide producers, and this was in the trial, there are some patients where their diarrhea and bloating's at a minimum, because the hydrogen sulfide is creating so much purging that they're expelling the gas as well. So we do see occasionally patients, but again, you won't know that until the hydrogen sulfide, you know, testing is available.
Any timeline on that?
You asked this already.
I know.
It's like a trick question.
It is.
I saw that trap.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I just thought maybe you were drifting. Okay. So on the breath test, my baseline was a 7 parts per million. This is Denise, and had to rise of 8 parts per million. So it was considered normal. I thought I heard you say that two parts per million or less is what you want for methane. Should I be doing something to address the high numbers of methanogens in my microbiome if I treat the hydrogen dominant SIBO?
Okay, so if methane, in our early studies, if methane was over 3 parts per million, we found that associated with constipation. So to the person who asked the question, if you are constipated and your methane rises to those levels of 8 or so, and you have the hydrogen, I would generally treat it because of our early data of the 3 part per million threshold. When the North American consensus was decided, you know, It's not decided by me. It's not decided by first author, Dr. Rezai. It's decided by a collective group of minds. And the majority felt that 10 would be a better threshold for certainty. And so that's why 10 came about. So we're all, I don't want to say stuck with 10, but until more data comes out, we're going to say it's 10 for the interpretation of the test. But you know, the North American consensus, not to keep belaboring this one question, but the North American consensus finally gave us guidelines so that, you know, all these doctors across the country doing breath tests were just willy-nilly, in some instances, telling people what their tests showed. We had to get like sort of a ground floor on things, get everybody on the same page, and then do science, and then in a couple of years, modify it according to the science. So that's it.
Okay. Pregnancy and pelvic floor issues and adhesions. I just want to circle back to that because some people might be thinking, well, I've never had, you know, a blockage. Could they still have adhesions? Would that be part of an adhesion scenario?
So it's pelvic floor dysfunction can be caused by blockages. So for, there's a number of things that can happen. If you've had, for example, a cesarean section for delivering, it's possible you can get adhesions from that. I had a patient, literally, it's funny you mentioned that, I want to say 6 weeks ago, and this is exactly the scenario. Ever since then, you know, my bowels haven't worked right, and it's adhesions. I've had patients where they went to the ER when they were 13 for abdominal pain, never had any problems since. Now they have bloating and distension, and it turns out they had appendicitis that healed, but now it formed a scar tissue, and it wrapped around the ileum, and now they've bloated and distended. We fixed it. They're fine. So all of these things are possible. One final thing is endometriosis can cause scarring, and that we do look for that. And that's an important cause in young women, especially women who have very heavy or irregular periods or pain with menstruation that's unusually elevated.
So this is about nerves, and we didn't really define exactly what the whole, you know, step-by-step process is of the, like, get the food poisoning, what it does to the interstitial cells of Cajal and all that. Do you want to do that in a super fast way?
Sure. No pressure. You're telling me to go faster.
Just on this little thing.
So yes, food poisoning, the toxin CDTB has similarity to vinculin. You form the antibodies. The antibodies react to all the nerve plexus of the gut. We showed that in a study, but specifically to the deep muscular plexus interstitial cells of Cajal, it's a mouthful. And those cells are really important for the cleaning waves of the gut. And we saw that those cells are diminished in people who got food poisoning and who developed SIBO. So less ICC cells, more SIBO. And that's the motility disruption.
And the motility disruption has to do with the migrating motor complex. So I'm just giving you guys some terminology for new people.
Right. But the higher the antibody, it could even damage other nerves. We're still working on that because we can't explain why some of these patients are so distended when the antivinculin is so high. It can't just be MMCs. It's got to be even deeper than that and worse than that. We're working through trying to figure out how bad things can get and how many nerves and what nerves are damaged.
Is that what neuropathy means?
Yeah, neuropathy. We call it visceral neuropathy or visceral myopathy when it gets so bad. It means that the bowel is just doesn't function. The muscles don't react. And part of that has to do with the nerves. Yes.
Okay. So Marianne, that addresses your question. Guys, there were so many questions. I'm trying to do these big sweeping questions to address a lot of people at the same time. And of course, it's not a substitute for a doctor's visit. So I'm trying to do the best I can to cover big and little pictures. Okay. I tested positive for hydrogen and methane, but have only methane symptoms. Do you have any idea why this is the case? I know that's kind of something we've covered before, but I think it's important for people who are just joining into this whole world of explanation from you.
So the explanation, the patient has no methane and has constipation. Is that what they're saying?
She tested positive for hydrogen and methane, but only has methane symptoms.
Okay. So in the study that we presented last DDW, and this paper is coming out very shortly, but we showed that methane is king or queen. I think it dominates the environment. When methane is present, doesn't matter how much hydrogen you have, you're going to be constipated. So you kind of got to treat both. What we do with methane, of course, as most of you know, is we give, based on the double-blind study we published, the combination of rifaximin and neomycin, or rifaximin and metronidazole is a substitute that we use in the clinic. Again, off-label use for the products, but they're usually successful in about 80% of cases. But here's this problem that we're trying to find the solution to again. Methane is tough. I mean, the patients do relapse more easily, and that's why we're looking at this lovastatin option, because we really struggle in that arena.
Okay, let's talk about the vagus nerve, because you and I haven't really talked a lot about that, that whole brain-gut connection. By the way, I once said mind-gut connection and was crossly corrected, not by you. So it is the brain-gut connection and the vagal nerve, vagus nerve. Can you talk to that for a bit and just explain to people that relationship?
Well, the irony of what you just said, correcting yourself, and I'm going to correct you again.
Yeah, do it.
At this DDW, they've changed the terminology one more time. Now they're calling it the gut-brain connection because they think that it's bad communication from the gut that is affecting the brain, sort of like the bugs. And basically they're suggesting that the microbiome can be causing depression and can be causing some of the neurological problems that people experience, Parkinson's and all of that. So stay tuned for a lot more data there by other people who are doing it, like John Cryan in the UK. But now I forgot your question. The vagus nerve is what you were thinking. How important is that? So we measure vagal nerve function in the clinic. We have a test that we do. There's a number of tests you can do, but one of the ones we do is to do a pancreatic polypeptide after a sham feed. It's a test that tells, I gotta explain it. See, you give me a question and then you expect me to do a short answer. So basically, the vagus turns on once you sit at a table and you're looking at food. The vagus turns on more once you start chewing the food. And of course, it turns on a lot when you swallow it. But if you just chew the food and spit it out, the vagus turns on and triggers the pancreas to release a chemical protein called pancreatic polypeptide, which we can measure in the blood. So if you chew and spit the food out and you don't have a rise in pancreatic polypeptide, it means the vagus ain't connected. And the vagus isn't functioning. And if the vagus is not functioning, that does or is can be associated with SIBO and a lot of sort of dysfunction of the upper gut. Actually, most of the gut, because the vagus controls all the small bowel or in part.
That is fascinating and totally worth every single word you just said, as usual.
So we do this, like, for example, people who've had surgery for reflux, like fundoplication, the vagus nerves can be damaged in some of those procedures. And so we do test the function in people who are very bloated or distended after the procedure.
And what about like concussions?
Yeah, so we do see some patients with concussions that develop SIBO. It's perplexing. Some of them do have that vagus dysregulation. Some of them don't. But yeah, we do see it. And usually, when you say concussion, what I'm thinking of is the patients in my clinic that have had a car accident. And then all of a sudden, ever since then, they've been bloated. And so I do see a lot of those. And the explanation for it could be vagal dysfunction, could be something in the brain that in the vagal nucleus that could be affecting gut function. It's possible.
Like traumatic brain injuries that are appearing to be much more common than anyone had ever suspected.
Yes, possible. And we do see cases like that.
Any thoughts about a hydrogen sulfide yeast candida connection?
So the person who could answer that much better than me is Satish Rao, who's studying yeast every day and is finding SIFO, small intestinal fungal overgrowth, in a small minority. But look, you know, if 70 is caused by bacterial, there's another 30 to explain. And he's saying between 10% and 15% of, quote, IBS or SIBO might be fungal in nature. we're in the Reimagine study, we do collect the information for fungus. We just haven't analyzed the data yet and done the libraries for fungus. But that will come. That'll come in this next 12 months.
Oh, that's exciting. That's great. And Dr. Rao is joining us in the speaker series in August. So we're
Good. Yeah, no, he's an expert on the fungus part, and you'll enjoy his commentary.
Yeah, he's got a lot of ideas about the old fungus among us. So what about diverticulitis, Teresa? This is for you, in the large intestine affecting SIBO treatment and is more likely to be in the small intestine if you have, is diverticulitis more likely to be in the small intestine if you have it in the large intestine?
So if you have, if I understand the question, diverticula, meaning pockets, in the colon, they're more common. In the small bowel, much less common. But there are patients who have small bowel diverticulosis. And I have one patient that I was treating for a number of years who the entire small bowel were diverticula. It was a disaster for them. And that is a well-known textbook kind of case where it's very difficult. They can't absorb food. They got overgrowth. Overgrowth never goes away because these pockets just keep holding the bugs. But if you have diverticula in the colon, in general, that's very common and doesn't really mean you have pockets in the small intestine. If you did a barium study, it would be most likely you don't have it. I would say that diverticula in the small bowel, I can count on both hands the number of patients I've seen over the last 10 years. So maybe 5 or 10. So it's rare.
So people are asking about what to do to heal and what to heal first. Do you start with IBS smart test and then adhesions, or, you know, do you have a checklist? Obviously it's patient specific, but any suggestions for people who have maybe not had their symptoms resolved after the famous sentence of I've tried everything, which obviously, well, you know, there's still something else to try.
Again, so I'm putting the patient in front of me as the center of my universe of what I need to do. The highest probability is that it's food poisoning. So I start with the IBS smart, because if it's positive, I'm almost done. Okay, then I might do the breath test after that. If the IBS smart is negative, breath test is positive, I'm looking for adhesions. If both are negative, problem is we don't have hydrogen sulfide, so it could be hydrogen sulfide. Then they're in this pot of conundrum where we have to look for celiac, look for things, maybe do endoscopy. Even if somebody else has done an endoscopy, I might repeat it because there's something wrong with the analysis of that individual. So if you do that approach, you save a lot of copay for the patient, because number one, it's well known in the medical literature, the sooner you get to diagnosis, the sooner you get to treatment, the cheaper it is for the patient and for the insurance company. Not that we're paying attention to insurance, but the patients pay tons out of pocket for all this stuff. So
one last question as we're wrapping up, and guys, we still have Dr. Seebecker who's going to be answering questions. I also know that there are a lot of you who are anxious to get your questions answered. So I'm going to have Gary Stapleton come on later to talk about SIBO breath testing. And I'm also going to try to wrap up anything I didn't get answered with God bless her, Dr. Mona Morstein. We're going to do a wrap up on Monday because I really want to over deliver for you all. I know there are a lot of you that are new. And so, you know, obviously we're here to serve and we're trying. Dr. Pimentel, Heather recently read that the gallbladder has ICCs, interstitial cells of Cajal. I said it right. Are these the same ones as in the migrating motor complex? Do antibodies impair gallbladder motility also? Great question, Heather.
It's an absolutely fantastic question that I have absolutely no answer to because I don't know. But what I do know is that the interstitial cells of Cajal, there are multiple types. The deep muscular plexus type of the small bowel are related to migrating motor complex. I have to go back to the textbooks to see, but I think the gallbladder does not have the deep muscular plexus type, but they do have others. And so there are ICC cells. It's possible that all of this neuropathy affects the gallbladder as well. We've always been suspicious that there's something, because there's a link between IBS and a higher proportion of people with sphincter of Oddi dysfunction part of the gallbladder system. So the answer is yes, but we need more information possibly.
So that sphincter business you just talked about, is that like the release of the bile and all that?
Yes, that's the sort of a control latch that allows the bile to get into the bowel.
And the ileocecal valve, all those valves.
All the valves, yeah.
All the valves, right. Okay, I am wrapping you up on time, as promised, always.
Perfect.
I thank you so much for being here. Dr. Seebecker, come on. And we will talk to you soon with more breaking news, I know. I thank you for all your continued work and success to you, sir. Prayers are with you.
Nice talking to everybody.
Bye, Mark.
Bye,
Elsa. Bye, Dr. P. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you so much.